Hello, I'm Andy Burnham, and welcome to Sparks. This week, frequency problems with Britain's fifth TV channel. Electricity from rubbish is becoming viable, and recycling elderly BMWs to environmental reports. Robot cameras in the TV studio, test card music you love to hate. Whatever happened to Ambisonics, a surround sound system from the 70s, an interview with Alan Hocking from Radio Cracker in Dudley. Lots more in the programme as well as your letters. It's Sparks every week on Radio Fax. Shame on you if you've not noticed that scores of radio stations have sprung up all over the country for this month only. They're all called Radio Cracker, and they're run by enthusiastic church groups to raise money for charity. Martin Dealey went to visit the station in Dudley and spoke to Alan Hocking.
If you've been tuning across the FM radio band over the past few days, you've probably heard a strange new addition to the Black Country Airwaves. I'm joined by the station manager, the programme controller of Radio Cracker, the new station from Dudley.
Yeah, I'm Alan Hocking, station manager, programme controller, and the clown who had the idea in the first place and gets all the bricks thrown at him.
So tell me, what's special about Radio Cracker?
Well, Radio Cracker is special because the idea is to raise over the airwaves £25,000 to help children in places like Fortaleza in Brazil, where they live on rubbish tips, they fight vultures for food, some of them live in the sewers to get out of the way of the illegal death squads that roam the streets, and if they catch them they just take them away and they're never seen again.
So how did this project actually begin? Obviously someone must have had the original idea.
Yeah, a fellow called Steve Chalk was the one who had the original idea, and under the new Broadcasting Act, of course, you can buy a licence and have a station for 28 days, and he thought this was a good idea, and the thing began to take off. It's a national thing, and there are, in fact, 95 cracker stations around the country, hoping to raise something like £1 million.
And have they all got the same aims and objectives as yourself?
Yes, they're all exactly the same in their aims, but of course the way that they go about it is totally different. We, of course, are the best.
It's obviously quite an ambitious project. How did you raise the money in the first instance to start what is quite a spectacular radio station?
Well, we got people to buy shares. We sold shares for £10 or whatever they wanted to give. People gave, businesses gave to us. It was a bit like Annika Rice, really. We were going around cadging, begging, borrowing, almost stealing, but not quite anything we could get hold of.
You assembled quite an interesting collection of equipment. You obviously had quite a few people who've been willing to share equipment and resources and finances with you.
Yes, we have. I mean, businesses have shared with us, people like MEB, Colourvision have lent us a couple of videos and a television, a group called Radio Worldwide lent us virtually a whole studio full of equipment, a firm, I don't know the name, who make mixers, lent us one of their professional mixers. So, you know, yes, people have been very cooperative and very helpful. Firm called Abasat, of course, lent us their a satellite dish and decoder so we could bring the news down from a satellite. So, yeah, very pleased with it.
Sounds very professional. So, on a local level, what do you hope Radio Cracker in the Black Country will achieve?
Well, we hope it'll raise people's awareness of the plight of these children. We hope that it'll cause people to want to give and to help. And also, one of the other aims, of course, is that Cracker is a Christian-based station. It's run mainly by churches and Christian youth groups. And we hope that we're going to perhaps raise the profile of Christmas a little bit from being the sort of commercialised thing that it has become to saying, hey, now, you know, do remember there was a birth at Bethlehem and it was all about the fact that Jesus came to be the saviour of the world, and perhaps get people thinking about that as well.
Well, you've obviously got no shortage of on-air staff either. to run a radio station for what obviously is 24 hours a day, how do you find the people to actually do that for you?
Well, they just turned up, you know. We had a couple of articles in the local papers, and the next thing I knew I was being besieged with phone calls from would-be DJs and some who had, shall we say, piratical experience. And so we interviewed them and auditioned them and found some very good fellows, and we're very pleased with the sound of the station. It's, as you've said yourself, and a lot of people have said to us, it does have quite a professional feel or sound to it.
Do many of them tend to think that this will give them a foothold into the broadcasting industry and will lead them on to bigger and better things?
I think some of them do have that hope, yes. It's getting them a bit more experience, a bit more credibility. Obviously, you can't really go to an employer, BBC or somebody like that, and say, well, I worked for such and such a pirate station. They wouldn't be very pleased to see them, perhaps. But having said they've worked for Radio Cracker and got a bit of experience that way, yes, I think probably that's some of them are looking for that, and we're quite happy to give them that experience.
So going back to the actual Radio Cracker here in Dudley, When did you start? How long are you going to be on air for? And is it going to be a permanent feature of the Dudley Airwaves?
Well, we started on the 30th of November, when Harry Harrison came along and did the honours for us. We go right through till midnight on Christmas Eve, when we have to shut down, because that's when the licence runs out. We shall all heave a great big sigh of relief, I think, to be quite honest. As to whether it could become a permanent feature, well, that we shall have to wait and see. I'd like to think that, yes, perhaps it would. But that's in the lap of the gods, as it were. We'll just have to wait and see what happens.
So when you finish broadcasting on Christmas Eve, what happens then? It's obviously not the end of the story for Radio Cracker. The money has to be collected, and what happens to it regionally and then nationally?
Well, it's all part of a national project. We send the money in. We're supposed to send it in every week, actually, into National Cracker, and they will then disperse it through relief agencies like Tear Fund, who are the main relief agency who will be handling it, and it will go off to where it's most needed.
So at this moment, we're just over 1 week into the project. Has it been successful?
I think so, yes. We haven't had as much money come in as we'd hoped we would, but I think the station has been a success. People are becoming more aware. We're doing road shows, we're going into schools, we're doing all sorts of things to raise people's awareness of the thing and tell them about it. And just this afternoon, as you know, we've been out having a road show in the Market Square in Dudley. A lot of people very interested, a lot of people giving dedications out there in the square, even filling the forms in there and then. So yes, you know, I think it has been successful, and we've had one or two very big donations which have helped boost the total. So I think at the moment we're running at about £5,000 or £6,000 towards it.
Well, I'd like to wish you all the best, and hope it's a massive success both for yourselves and for the children in Brazil.
Thanks very much. Nice to talk to you.
Martin Dealey reporting for Radio Fax. He lives in Kings Winford in the West Midlands. And if you think you can do an item of that quality and send it into Radio Fax, well, feel free. Our address, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. I've been listening to some of the Radio Cracker stations as well. And in Nottingham, there's a station which is of rather poor reception, and I have to say I'm not impressed with the programming. Heard better at some of the amateur campus stations I've been to. However, down in the London area, Wimbledon Morden area, is a station with a sort of pirate feel, playing soul dance, that sort of music mainly, and overall very smooth presentation style. In Cheam, which is quite near me, there's a station. They are more mainstream, and the presentation style there is generally good. And there's a Radio Cracker station down in Godalming, which I haven't heard. However, I hope they get some more publicity, because apparently the local free newspaper hasn't been publicising them, because they're owned by the same group as County Sound. So it's nice to know that the spirit of Christmas is down there in Godalming as well. Just, 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 just
each and every day.
Observer, waste not, want not, to fuel a green future. The prospects for converting waste into energy are limitless, reports Mike Flood. Old car tyres, chicken droppings, pig slurry, municipal refuse, straw, forestry residues, rotting vegetables and a host of other unsavoury organic wastes look like becoming the feedstock for a new energy industry in Britain. 57 energy from waste projects received the go-ahead in the recently announced non-fossil fuel obligation, three-quarters of the total generating capacity allocated to renewable energy. But the total represented a small fraction of UK potential, only 336 megawatts. Britain generates some 250 million tonnes of organic matter a year, and much of this is dumped into holes in the ground, discharged, untreated into rivers, or burnt unproductively in the field. Recovering energy from waste has two functions. It disposes of difficult and often unpleasant wastes, and it displaces polluting fossil fuels. Given sufficient effort, waste could replace the equivalent of 10 million tonnes of coal a year early next century. Wastes can be burnt directly, or broken down mechanically, biologically, or with heat to produce a range of premium fuels suitable for engines, boilers, and furnaces. The most widely used and best understood process is anaerobic digestion, which produces a combustible mixture of methane and carbon dioxide. 60% of sewage is treated like this. Waste can also be fermented to alcohol or gasified by starved air combustion. Domestic refuse and trade waste represents the single largest unused biomass resource. More than 25 million tonnes are produced annually, and 90% of this goes to landfill, sometimes creating serious problems because of methane gas migration and leachate, which threatens groundwater. Several hundred landfill sites have been condemned. Sir Hugh Rossi, chairman of the Parliamentary Committee on the Environment, recently described the situation as appalling. Collecting the gas and burning it as fuel provides an interim solution to the problem, but in the longer term, other ways must be found. 37 landfill gas schemes are now operating in the UK, and more are planned. 28 were included in the latest NFFO order, with 19 sewage gas projects. At 17 sites, landfill gas is used to fire brick kilns or raise steam for industry. At the remaining 20, it generates electricity. The total installed capacity is 32 megawatts. One enterprising company in the north of England is actually using landfill gas on a koi carp fish farm. The premium prices paid under the NFFO for electricity have revived interest in waste burning. Private producers are rewarded with a 6.55p a kilowatt hour fee, twice what it costs to generate from coal. The £95 million North Deptford plant was originally intended to supply heat for about 10,000 homes, as well as making electricity from the grid, making it highly energy efficient. But these plans are now on the back burner, so to speak, ironically because of the NFFO. Producing heat would mean sacrificing electricity, and this is ruled out by the high electricity prices now available. This month also sees the start of construction of a new tyre-burning plant in Wolverhampton, which will handle between 8 and 10 million scrap tyres a year, 90,000 tonnes, almost a quarter of the total produced in the UK. The plant will deliver 25 megawatts of power to the grid. Not all plants now on the drawing board will be built. Those most likely to succeed are where the management has taken the trouble to consult with local people and explain its plans. One of the greatest obstacles to progress in this area is the public fear of the unknown. Written by Dr. Mike Flood, an independent consultant on energy and the environment in The Observer.
Old bangers never die, they simply get recycled. Sue Baker. On car recycling in The Observer. Like the talons of a bird of prey, the giant metal claw fell on the rusting hulk of an elderly BMW and snatched it skywards. A few seconds later, it dropped the car into the waiting jaws of the steel crusher. With shrieks of compressing metal, it was baled into a tidy cube. This was the usual end for an unwanted car, but with a difference. This car, a 14-year-old BMW 525, with 160,000 miles on the clock, had been drained of fluids and stripped of every part capable of recycling. All that remained was the steel, a little non-ferrous metal, and general debris of glass and rust. I was watching the ignominious end of a once-loved car at a dismantling centre in Munich, where techniques developed at BMW's pioneering Landshut car recycling plant are now being put into daily practice. Petrol, brake fluid, oil and the radiator coolant are drained and sent for reprocessing by specialist companies. The engine is reconditioned to be sold refurbished with a year's guarantee for 30% less than the price of a new engine. Plastic components are graded into six major types. This car yielded 11 pounds of ABS plastic from the air intake grills and door pockets, 2 pounds of PUR foam from the headrests, 17 pounds of polyamide from the carpets and boot linings, 6 pounds of polypropylene from the toolbox and heater ducts, 2 pounds of polymethyl methacrylate from the rear lamp clusters, and 4 pounds of polyethylene from the radiator expansion tank and ventilation ducts. All will be reprocessed into new parts. The car's seats yield at 28 pounds of rubberized hair, which can be recycled. Seat belt webbing provides fibres which can be reused to weave new belts. The 66 pounds of window glass will also be reprocessed. Only the rear screen is scrapped because at the moment its heating element makes recycling difficult. By this meticulous dismantling, the car's scrap value is increased. Stripped of all its non-metallic parts and without fluid, the clean and dry scrap body, which is baled and then sent for shredding, is worth more than contaminated scrap. That helped push the scrap value of this particular car to 400 Deutschmarks, around £140. The cost of disposing was 200 Deutschmarks, so the last owner was paid 200 Deutschmarks. German car owners cannot simply dump an unwanted vehicle. By law, they continue to be liable for tax and insurance, typically about £500 a year, unless they deregister the car, which can only be done with a certificate from the dismantlers. BMW was the first car maker to set up a recycling plant, joined almost immediately by Volkswagen. Mercedes, Opel, Ford of Germany and Peugeot Citroën in France have now followed suit. Rover is not far behind, having just announced a joint research programme with the Bird Group, one of Europe's leading reclamation companies. Since its Landshut pilot plant opened in 1990, BMW has put considerable effort into developing techniques for recycling material in existing cars and designing more recyclability into new models. According to Dr. Horst Henning Wolf, BMW's vehicle recycling project manager, a typical car today is about 75% recyclable. The latest 3 Series BMW is already better than average at 80%. The target for future models is 90% within 3 to 5 years, and ultimately 95% of a car should be capable of recycling within a decade. It is unlikely we can go much beyond that. I think there will always be about 5% of a car left over as what we call fluff, debris, which is mostly unusable glass, rust, the remains of the underfloor protection and so on, says Dr. Wolf. Germany remains ahead of most of the rest of the world in developing and applying recycling techniques. The newly opened Preismesser Recycling Centre in Munich is the first of a chain of centres across Germany. They will not be confined to dismantling BMWs, but techniques for each car differ, and manufacturers must develop expertise for their own ranges. Although Britain lags behind Germany in recycling, developments are on the way. In the next 6 months, 100 cars are to be put through dismantling trials at a pilot plant at Long Marston, near Stratford-upon-Avon, as part of Rover's programme with the Bird Group. By the end of next year, the first car dismantling centre in Britain is due to be set up by BMW as part of a plan to establish 10 British recycling centres within 3 years. Sue Baker in The Observer.
Learn to love me, assemble the ways. Now, today, tomorrow, and always. My only weakness is a list of crimes. My only weakness is, well, never mind, never mind. Chop the letters of the world. Unite and take over. Stop the lifters of the world. Hand it over, hand it over, hand it over. Learn to love me and assemble their ways. Now, today, tomorrow and always. My only weakness is a list of crimes. But last night the plans for a future war was all I saw on Channel 4. Sharp lifters of the world, unite and take over. Sharp lifters of the world, hand it over, hand it over, hand it over. Of the world.
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofax Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherland receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England, 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England, 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
A couple of items here about the 48-metre band that you might have missed from Media Network.
Let's go now to the answer line, Hilversum 724222, our English answer line, where there's a call waiting.
Hello, this is Julius Hermans from Vleuten in Holland. A familiar voice has returned to the shortwave bands. It's Radio Dublin, the famous Irish pirate, and they're now back again on their usual frequency of 6910. That's 6910. I heard them this morning, Sunday morning at 8 o'clock UTC, with a program of non-stop music and jingles like Dublin's good music. So that's Radio Dublin returned to the shortwave bands on 6910. Thank you.
Thank you, Julius. Actually, it seems the station's been on the air for the last couple of weeks, so it's interesting to see how quickly people pick up on it. Now, as that station's come on the air, so another station's gone off, Andy.
Yes, the Irish station Harmony Radio, which had been on 6305 kHz for some months, has apparently suspended its operations because its American backers have pulled out. They've been unable to sell any airtime. However, there are rumours of a new religious-type operation starting soon.
Media Network, supplied free with every shortwave radio.
Jonathan Marks and Andy Sennett there from World Radio TV Handbook on Radio Netherlands Media Network.
In Electronics Times, French concern over the levels of background radiation has prompted the government to install radiation monitors throughout the country. Anyone in France who wishes to check the level of radiation in their area can ring a special number on their Minitel terminal, which is like a Prestel terminal, and there's one in almost every French home. Readings are taken throughout the country every quarter of an hour. The country's Service for the Protection Against Ionising Radiation has installed 70 Swedish-made radiation monitors 100 kilometres apart. They measure the smallest levels of radiation. The decision to go ahead and buy the monitors, costing more than £2,000 each, was triggered off by the Chernobyl disaster. Another short story, this time in The Independent. A pirate broadcaster transmitted John Wayne westerns and television comedies from makeshift studios in his mother's cottage, a court was told recently. Robin Parker, aged 45, had recently completed a 2-year conditional discharge for similar offences when he transmitted Play School, magistrates at Wanford in Devon were told. Parker, who's unemployed of Tedburn St Mary, started broadcasting as soon as his 2-year ban was up, the court was told. Gareth Owens, prosecuting, said among the programmes he transmitted were One Foot in the Grave and John Wayne Westerns. Parker pleaded guilty to 2 charges under the Wireless Telegraphy Act. Sentence was adjourned for social inquiry reports. You're listening to Radio Fax, and today it's Sparks. Other Radio Fax programmes start on Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays. and we'd love to receive your letter. I guarantee to read any written to me out on air. Here's one from Alan Dean, who writes in very regularly with his shortwave reports, which I'll have in a moment. He's from Padiham, Burnley in Lancashire. Pleased to hear the introduction of 3910 during the evening hours. Reception is normally good on this frequency. Finally, with the year nearly at an end, let us hope that 92 may be the year you manage to obtain your licence. Well, we can live in hope. We certainly can, Alan. Thanks for that. He reports the following Merseyside stations on at the moment. Toxteth Community Radio, 104.9, daily with a good mixture of programming. Choice FM, normally on weekends, 101 MHz. Laser FM, 100.3 in the evening. Kiss FM, 100 MHz, with taped programming. They're 24 hours. Also, two Asian stations operating from Blackburn in Lancashire, continuing daily on 100 and 101, and they're in Asian languages. So he can't get a station ID. Voice of the United Arab Emirates, English daily from 10 o'clock until midnight in the evening on 7215, 9600 and 11965. Transmission includes a relay at 10:30 and 11 o'clock a local FM station, Capital Radio. At the time of writing, the Caroline ship is still in the Dover docks. Salvage costs still not paid, and reports state that the ship is in a poor state of repair. Reports from Portugal state that the ex-laser ship is in dock there, recently having been repainted and having two aerial masts on board. Any regular Sparks listeners who would like to keep up to date with what's happening on the bands may like to join the World DX Club. They have a monthly magazine called Contact, which is full of DX news, QSL information, station logs, and much more. Sample copies are available from Mr. Arthur Ward, 17 Motspur Drive, Northampton, NN2, 6LY. Please enclose 80 pence from the UK or two or three international reply coupons from elsewhere. The address is 17 Motspur Drive, Northampton, NN2, 6LY. Mr. Arthur Ward, who is involved with Contact, the monthly magazine of the World DX Club, recommended by Alan Dean. English to Europe from Radio Afghanistan is daily from 6 until 7 in the evening. The frequency is 6145, 7215 and 9635. The first two are via the Soviet Union. The other one is direct from Afghanistan. Adventist World Radio has English daily from 8:30 until 9 o'clock in the morning and from 11:30 until 12 o'clock. From Forli in Italy on 7230. In addition, on Sundays, English is also heard from 9 till 10 in the morning on 9670 from Sines in Portugal. He reports the return of Radio Merlin, much welcomed on 6240 on the 1st of December. Radioactive heard for the first time on the 1st of December on 6262 via the Northern Ireland Relay Service. They stated they'd be on air the first Sunday of each month from 9 until 11 in the morning. That's 6262 to listen out for Radio Active. Also Radio Reflex, regular on most Sundays on 6220 from the Netherlands. I heard that last Sunday. It was rather good. The new Voice of America relay station went on the air on 6th of December in Botswana. The station's audible here. Try after 4 o'clock in the evening on 15445. Radio Morocco has a daily English transmission heard well here on the air from 3:30 until 5 on 17595. That's Radio Morocco. And something new to listen out for from Croatia, new Radio Zagreb on 6210 in the evenings. I wonder how many other shortwave stations will be popping up from the various Russian republics as the months go by. Very interesting listening, I would have thought. It's Sparks on Radio Fax. The address again, if you'd like to write to us, and I sincerely hope you do, it's Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG.
We're so glad to see so many of you lovely people here tonight, and we would especially like to welcome all the and join us here in the Palace Hotel ballroom at this time. We do sincerely hope you all enjoy the show. And please remember, people, that no matter who you are and what you do to live, thrive, and survive, there are still some things that make us all the same. You, me, them, everybody. Everybody.
Everybody needs somebody. Everybody needs somebody to love. Someone to love.
Someone to love.
Sweetheart to miss.
Sweetheart to miss.
Sugar to kiss.
Sugar to kiss.
First, it was the automotive industry, then consumer electronics. Now, the robot is automating television station operations, with savings on camera operator salaries the driving force. Ian White in International Broadcasting, Day of the Robots. The robotic camera market in Europe is dominated by two manufacturers. Luckily for Vinton Broadcast and Radomec EPO, increasing competition and decreasing budgets are starting a robot revolution, with indications that all news and current affairs programmes, as well as many game shows, may soon be produced using the latest camera robotics technology. The overriding reason for the development of studio robots is simply that the consequent reduction in the number of camera operators dramatically cuts production costs. Four robot cameras controlled by one operator effectively means that three camera operators will be out of work. With television stations typically spending over half their revenue on staff and space, the long-term cost savings could be considerable. As a result, manufacturers claim that most robotic systems should, in theory, pay for themselves within 18 to 24 months. However, few would argue that programs produced with robot cameras look any better than those produced conventionally by skilled camera operators on the studio floor. A good cameraman is constantly adjusting a combination of dolly or pedestal position, lens angle, and pan angle to produce a well-framed image. In a robotic application, one operator may be required to control 3 to 5 cameras and simply cannot work to the same level of detail. This is due to reduced manpower, and not a limitation of camera robotics per se. Robotics systems behave differently to manned cameras. Anyone who has had a close encounter with a robot pedestal and camera head moving Dalek-like across the studio floor will surely agree. They have both strengths and weaknesses compared to manned cameras. Robotics will save production costs, but it is important to tailor the system so that it can deliver the quality expected by the viewer. For instance, studio sets have to be relatively simple and designed so that robot pedestals, which cannot move as fast as their manual equivalents, travel minimum distances accurately between camera positions. Though robotics technology is advancing rapidly, programs including a lot of haphazard on-screen movement or any unscripted elements are still unsuitable. The advantages, however, are that robot systems can be made to learn complex pan, tilt, elevation, and XY floor movements, as well as focus and zoom, repeating them exactly on cue. Many systems can be interfaced to news computers, and the operator can improve communications by sitting in the same control room as the director and vision mixer. This ideally suits most newsroom and remote studio applications. Many broadcasters now favour a combination of robot and manned cameras, while others have moved wholly over to robot systems. Remotely controlled pedestals are much more ordered and dignified in their movements. The important thing to remember about robotic systems is that all the shots necessary to perform a show are pre-stored and can be recalled in sequence either by an operator or another computer system. This means that the program being broadcast is well ordered and therefore very efficient. Remote camera control systems have been around for a long time. The BBC was using them at Alexandra Palace in the 60s, and almost all television news studios incorporate some remote control equipment. The difference between remote control and robotics lies in the latter's increased manoeuvrability and its facility to store and repeat complex sequences. While there are a number of companies who manufacture remote control camera systems for broadcast, corporate television and surveillance applications, there are only two at the top of the robotics market in Europe, and rivalry is consequently fierce. Both Vinton and Radomec EPO have been around a long time. It was an EPO system that was used by the BBC at its Alexandra Palace newsroom. These days, both manufacturers can boast impressive installations and a long list of broadcast customers. For instance, there is a 9-camera Radomec system in use at Independent Television News in London. Vinton, meanwhile, has recently installed a 4-camera robot pedestal system at CBS Broadcast's Evening News Studio 47 in New York. Radomec provided the remote control camera system for the United Kingdom's House of Commons. And Vinton provided 35 robotic camera heads for Parliament House in Canberra, Australia. In fact, both companies have recently received Emmy Awards for their robotic development work. That was by Ian White.
This week on Sparks, frequency problems with Britain's fifth TV channel. Electricity from rubbish is becoming viable and recycling elderly BMWs. Test card music you love to hate. Whatever happened to Ambisonics, a surround sound system from the 70s? An interview with Alan Hocking from Radio Cracker in Dublin. Lots of other bits and pieces, and of course, your letters.
Years of Radio Jackie. This LP record traces the story from early operations in fields through High Street Studios to the final close down.
Police with tracker dogs and post office detection men raided a pirate radio station in South London yesterday. Radio Jackie, which was said to broadcast for 6 hours every Sunday afternoon, was manned by about 15...
On March the 7th, 1972, Radio Jackie made parliamentary history when a tape of the station was played to a committee of the House of Commons during a debate on the Sound Broadcasting Bill. This tape, the first ever to be played in the House, was used to illustrate how commercial radio could sound if it were legalized in Great Britain.
Radio Jackie.
Jackie. Jackie.
The station that fits snugly into your ear.
Radio Jackie. The sound of Southwest London. Radio Jackie. The sound of Southwest London.
This is Channel 4.
A new crackdown on pirate radio by the Independent Broadcasting Authority. But is the IBA acting in the public interest?
This is Angela Rumbold, Member of Parliament for Mitcham and Morden. As many of you will know who are regular listeners to Radio Jackie, the government has introduced legislation recently which may put Radio Jackie's future at jeopardy.
From the bustle of suburbia to the rolling Surrey Downs.
From houseboats on the River Thames to office blocks in town.
Close enough to really care as Brent should always be. We're Southwest London's favourite station, Radio Jackie.
In the last 16 years, I mean, Radio Jackie's done nothing but good, and the events leading to its closure are monstrous.
These fascinating recordings, with a booklet of photographs all about Radio Jackie, are yours for £6. For Europe, it's £8. And with airmail to the rest of the world, £10. Order your copy now from Radio Jackie, 120 London Road, Morden, England, SM4 5AT.
Spend my time drinking wine, feeling fine, waiting here to find the sign that I can understand. Yes, I am. In the days between the hours, ivory towers, bloody flowers, push their heads into the air. I don't care if I ever know. There I go. Pad before my eyes, paper cries, telling lies. The promises you gave from the grave of a broken heart. Every day I spend my time drinking wine, feeling fine, waiting here to find the sign that I can understand. Yes, I am.
We'll be right back.
Lovers of test card music, stand by.
Now, what do you like to watch on TV? Steamy scenes from the men's room, the latest movies? How about the test card? That what goes down a bomb with the 70-strong members of the Test Card Society, and this is just a little bit of music from the test card. If you've not seen it, and you have to get up at about 6 o'clock in the morning to see it nowadays, it was a device that used to appear through a lot of the day on TV, a series of boxes and lines on a card to check transmitters and help engineers line up sets. Now, while you and I are settling in to watch EastEnders or Panorama, Circle members are dropping by at each other's homes to turn on the video and enjoy some of those highlights of test card history and lose themselves in some of the 3,500 pieces of accompanying music. One of the organisers of these tele-test card addicts is Tony Emery from Bournemouth. Mike Thompson spoke to him on the phone and got him to explain the phenomenon.
For me, it started when I was about 4 or 5 years old. Watch with Mother would come to an end, on would come the test card, and I thought, goodness, this is good. Somehow it was illicit, it was designed for engineers, and I was at home watching it, you know, and it's grown and grown over the last 40 years.
But doesn't watching a test card for several hours get just a tinge boring?
Oh, that's a popular misconception. We don't actually do that. We listen to the music. That's primarily the whole point of the thing. The music that was used with the test card covers such an enormous range. There's something there for everybody. And when you've heard the pieces a few times, you just fall in love with them.
But wouldn't it be far easier to trot down to a record shop and buy the music?
No, well, the whole point is that for contractual reasons, the music used with the BBC test card was not available to the general public. And so you couldn't go down and buy that music. And somehow, it seemed to have a style all of its own.
But what's your favourite test card? Is it perhaps the little girl with the blackboard?
I like all the test cards, but my personal favourite is Test Card C, which was current when I started watching in the early 50s.
So what actually happens when you get together in a friend's house for a typical test card circle evening?
Well, then we will reconstruct the trade test transmissions. Several of us are now equipped for reconstructing a day in the life of BBC Two, perhaps in the early 70s or BBC One in the 50s. We have all the cards on video now. We have all the music within the circle that was ever used. We have copies of the trade test colour films. And we can mix them all together and do exactly what the BBC used to do. We're listening to the music. We're discussing the whole subject. We're saying, oh, I've got that tape. Oh, I haven't. Oh, well, I'll send you a copy then.
What sort of people make up this circle?
Oh, people from all walks of life, if that's not a cliche. I personally am a radio engineer. We have professional musicians. We have TV engineers. We have insurance men. We have just about everybody.
Would you like to see the test card broadcast at peak time so that more people could open their eyes to its attractions?
Well, I think you'd have difficulty justifying the licence fee if you did. It's a minority interest, and I appreciate it's a minority interest.
But you think it could attract an audience if people were given a chance to watch?
I think if the music were made commercially available, then yes.
What do you have to say to those who may be thinking now, your circle is just a little bit dull and dotty, and watching paint dry might be a more interesting way to spend the evening?
That sort of comment is normally made with great respect by people who have never taken the trouble to listen to an appreciable quality of test card music. There is literally something for everybody. Mozart and Delibes at one end, right up to pop vocals at the other end.
So you believe if people did sit down and watch and listen, they might learn something?
Yes, indeed.
Tony Emery from Bournemouth. Not much of a plot, but no sex or swearing. At least you can say that for it, can't you?
Well, I'm sure it beats listening to shortwave anyway. That was from Radio 4, You and Yours.
And what precisely is wrong with listening to shortwave? It's Sparks on Radio Facts. Russian scientists have developed a video disc that records HDTV using holograms. It stores the spatial spectrum of HDTV pictures, encoded using Fourier techniques. Holographic storage is well suited to HDTV because of its depth of detail and fast access. The St. Petersburg scientists are looking for a manufacturer for the disc.
Sooner or later, this happens to everyone. To everyone.
to everyone, to everyone.
Whatever happened to ambisonics? The ambisonic surround sound system was developed in Britain during the 1970s, hard on the heels of the so-called quadraphonic techniques, and became tarred with the same brush. For a number of reasons, more political than technical, it has up to now only received limited acceptance in the consumer and professional audio marketplaces. But now all that is changing. Major interest from Japanese hi-fi manufacturers and the current interest in encode-only stereo enhancement are bringing the system back into the limelight. But according to Richard Elan in Audio Media magazine, who has been working with the system for over 15 years, it never went away. Ambisonics was the brainchild of a small group of British academics, notably Michael Gerzen of the Mathematical Institute in Oxford. From the beginning, it was designed as a surround sound system that would overcome the major problems of the so-called quadraphonic systems that were its predecessors, the main one being that they simply didn't work very well. Research rapidly indicated, however, that in addition to providing full surround sound in an encode-decode environment, where the original recording is encoded into a stereo or mono-compatible form for transmission and later decoded by the listener into a multiple speaker feeds, ambisonics could also offer a significant super stereo capability without decoding. With current interest in single-ended stereo enhancement techniques like the Roland sound system and Q-Sound, it's interesting to note that ambisonic processing equipment has been used as a single-ended stereo enhancement device by radio stations, now especially AM stereo stations in the States, for almost a decade. Ambisonics built on the astonishing work on stereo recording and reproduction performed by Britain's early audio genius, Alan Dower Blumlein. Blumlein was working on stereo recording and disc cutting in the 20s, and as well as developing the stereo cutting system introduced over 30 years later for microgroove stereo LPs, he also invented what is at once the simplest and most accurate of all stereo recording systems, MS coincident pair recording. At a time when Bell Laboratories in the States were also investigating stereo, but with omnidirectional spaced microphones, Blumlein realized that there was more to the ear brain's combination ability to position sound source in space than merely the difference in level between the two ears. The principle is easily illustrated by considering a conventional mixing console panpot being used to pan a mono signal between two speakers. An illustration that indicates too how little Blumlein's work is now remembered in the audio industry. Something we often forget when we mix a multi-track tape to stereo is that what we're doing really represents the spatial localization of sound sources very poorly. Where we place a track in the space between the speakers is purely a matter of which speaker is louder than the other. That's what a panpot does. Send all the signal to the left speaker, and it comes from the left. Send equal levels to both speakers, and it's in the middle. Or is it? Just imagine that you're listening to a sound that's center stage. It has equal levels on both channels, and your meters will read identical values. But now move to the left, and what happens? The sound follows you to the left, because now there's more energy reaching you from the left than the right. That's the main drawback of the system, because it's not stereo at all, it's pan-potted mono. When we listen to sounds in real life, they don't behave like that. The reason is that level between our two ears is just one of the methods we use to localize sound sources in space. There are two others, phase and the Haas effect. Some researchers think that they're at least as important as level. If a sound is off to one side, we still hear it with both ears, but there is a difference between the signals arriving at the two ears. Apart from differences in level, and high frequency content for that matter, there's another factor, phase. The wave fronts from the sound source don't reach the ears at exactly the same time, and we interpret that phase difference as localization information. It's a very impressive effect if you try it yourself in the studio. A simple method of experimenting with phase-based localization is to set up a pair of delay lines, one variable and the other fixed. Send the same mono signal to both of them and pan the output of one hard left and the other hard right. Make sure that only the delayed signal is delivered to the output, none of the input signals should be heard, and that the levels from both digital delay lines is identical. Set the delay on the fixed delay line to 100 milliseconds. Set up the other delay to a basic length of 100 milliseconds too, but with a knob to vary the delay equally above and below this figure. Now vary the delay back and forth either side of the 100 millisecond position, and either side of that position you will hear that without changing the levels at all, you can create a remarkable panning effect. You'll notice that at some settings, sounds can even seem to go way beyond the loudspeakers. Switch your monitoring into mono while you do this, by the way, and you'll hear a familiar sound, the swooshing effect of the true tape phasing or flanging. This was how, using tape machines, record play head delays instead of digital delay lines, George Kiantz at Olympic Studios produced the original sound of phasing on the Small Faces hit Ichiku Park, possibly its first controlled use. The effect had been used on the soundtrack of a 50s movie, The Big Hurt, but this was done by running two identical copies of a piece of music together and changing the speed of one of them to bring it into sync, a rather haphazard way of creating the effect. The third method of spatial localization used by the ear-brain combination is called the Haas effect, after the man who discovered it. The theory is simple. If we hear a sound directly, but we also hear it at the same time indirectly, say bouncing off a wall, two signals arrive at the ears. The direct sound arrives first, but the reflected sound turns up just a little later. The brain rightly interprets that second arrival as a reflection and doesn't confuse it with the true direction of the sound. We're talking here of significant delays in the order of tens of milliseconds. Exactly what delay you can hear will vary between people. Try it with the same setup as described earlier, but set the delays to different values and listen without twiddling at the same time. But you will notice how the delay is ignored as a localization cue when it becomes longer than a certain amount. This is why, if you delay a sound and split it hard left and right in a mix, a useful production technique, you have to increase the level of the delayed sound to make it appear equally balanced with the direct sound on the other channel. The extra level is needed to fool the brain into thinking that the delayed sound is something different with its own localization. Coincident pair stereo is a remarkable technique. It is perhaps the simplest microphone technique that approaches our own hearing in its ability to reproduce spatial information. On speakers at a true 60 degrees to each other, as stereo speakers are meant to be, the sound has remarkable depth. It isn't just a straight line between the speakers, and it is also incredibly stable, sounding more or less the same wherever you are between the speakers, unlike pan-potted mono. On headphones, you can actually seem to hear things behind you, and occasionally even above you. This is not as unlikely as it sounds. Do we need ears in the back of our head to hear things going on behind us? No. The front-back asymmetry of our ears changes the characteristics of sounds heard from behind us as compared to those in front. Ambisonics is simply Blumlein's stereo system extended into three dimensions. Three? Yes. Ambisonics is capable of encoding sound sources from any direction in space, including vertically. The technique employed in an ambisonic microphone is to use the equivalent of a single omnidirectional capsule plus three figure-of-eight capsules, one pointing left-right, one front-back, and the other up-down. In most ambisonic microphones, such as the Calrec Soundfield mic and its successors like the AMS ST250, these four polar diagrams are simulated by a tetrahedral array of capsules. This has the benefit of also allowing them to be electronically corrected for true coincidence, because the closer together the capsules are, the more accurate the localization is, particularly at high frequencies. This is one of the reasons that the Soundfield microphones are excellent MS stereo mics, as well as having their somewhat underexploited surround sound benefits. A Soundfield microphone is just that, a device for capturing all the sounds in an environment so that they can be stored in such a way as to make it possible to regenerate in the listening environment the original pattern of sound waves falling on the microphone. Soon after the development of the Soundfield microphone, developments began to be made in the field of simulating sound fields as well as simply capturing them. The result is that today there are comprehensive mixing systems that allow individual multitrack signals to be pan-potted into an ambisonic picture. If a traditional Blumlein MS coincident pair gives you two signals which are needed to be decoded to derive the left and right speaker feeds, it's fairly obvious that a three-dimensional Blumlein system will give you more of the same. In fact, the studio format for ambisonics, generally known as B format, is exactly this: a mono sum signal from the omnidirectional component, left plus right plus front plus back plus up plus down, known as the W component, plus three different signals, front-back, left-right, and up-down. Notice that only four channels are needed to encode not only surround information, but also height. So, why did the old quad systems need four channels? To encode simple horizontal sound. The so-called quadrophony was a rather unfortunate failed series of attempts to persuade people to buy twice as many amplifiers and loudspeakers. Produced in the early 70s, when the technology was really not up to it, the systems available offered various combinations of problems with occasionally some interesting effects. At the root of quadrophonic's problems were several misconceptions. The idea was to reproduce the sound field, which of course exists all round the listener, but the idea that this could be represented by recording four channels and replaying them through four speakers at 90 degrees to each other around the listener was simply incorrect. You can obtain some impressive effects, but in terms of accuracy, the results were disappointing. One reason is that stereo simply does not work with speakers at 90 degrees. You get holes between them. At the root of quad was the idea of using pan-potted mono in two dimensions with four channels, and some of the so-called discrete or 4-to-4-4 systems did no more than this, utilizing some and different signals in the same way as they're used in FM stereo, with subcarriers on vinyl discs to get the mono-compatible sum signals in the normal groove and the different signals modulated on subcarriers. The listener without a decoder simply heard the baseband signals, left front plus left rear on one side and right front plus right rear on the other, and missed out on the different signals encoded on the high-frequency subcarriers. To offer stereo compatibility without subcarriers, many of the several systems available attempted to matrix the original four discrete channels down to two using phase relationships to encode the surround positions, and then somehow recover the original four signals in the decoding process. These systems were often referred to as 4-to-4 systems, four original signals matrixed into two transmission channels and then decoded into the original four again. Unfortunately, this is mathematically impossible, and 4-to-2-to-2.5 would have been a better name for them. Instead of a sound panned around the room in a circle actually going around the room in a circle, it would do something else. In one case, it went around a shallow ellipse with a little front-back definition. In another, the front stage was fine, but the rear was a very odd shape, with centre rear being in the centre of the listening area. The solution to poor localisation was a system called logic decoding. The principle here was that if there was, say, one sound source playing, the system could work out where it was supposed to be and turn the other speakers down. That's fine, as long as there's only one thing going on. Of course, there never is. The original quadraphonic systems died out, but two developments of them were left behind. One was Dolby Surround, which is now widely used in the film industry. It owes a lot to two of the commonest quadraphonic systems, CBS's SQ and Sansui's QS systems. As its heritage might suggest, it is excellent for impressive sound effects and ambience, but it is not highly accurate in its representations of localization. It's not intended to be, and it is sometimes quite difficult to work with. Logic decoding means that when several widely spaced sounds are present, the sound stage tends to collapse, as the logic decoding is rendered less effective by the multiple sources. Not everything that came out of quadraphonic developments was flawed, however. One subcarrier system, developed by Nippon Columbia and called UD4, the UD standing for Universal Discrete, successfully recreated a circular locus in the listening environment. As a quadraphonic system, however, it had limited success. The big challenge for ambisonics was how to get the four sum and difference signal components into a form that was stereo and mono compatible, so that the system was able to interface successfully with existing systems. This was a challenge that Quad had failed, both with the expense and difficulty of subcarrier systems, with their special styli and loss of subcarrier information due to record wear, and with the inability of matrix systems to recover all the surround information successfully. The answer was a phase encoding matrix that brought together work carried out by the ambisonic team, the BBC, and some of the original designers of the UD4 system. The ambisonic team had developed a matrix called 45J, and the BBC were doing test transmissions with matrix H. Adding a dash of UD4, the UHJ system was born. If ambisonics is so wonderful, how come we aren't all using it? The answer is a sad tale of bad luck and politics. Part of a long article there by Richard Elan. One-time pirate radio operator on a station legendary for its creativity, Radio London Underground. some items in Television Magazine about the proposed idea for a Channel 5 on UHF in Great Britain. After carrying out a feasibility study, the board of CLT, the Luxembourg Broadcasting Company, has decided against putting in a bid for the Channel 5 franchise. The study suggested that the cost of setting up the network would be around £500 million, far more than previously thought. CLT feels that the only feasible way of providing a Channel 5 service would be via a transponder on Astra. Bids for the Channel 5 franchise have to be submitted during 1992. The problem of interference to domestic electronic equipment caused by Channel 5 transmissions could be rather greater than has so far been admitted. It's not only a question of VCRs, but of satellite receivers, video games, etc. The Channel 5 licensee will be responsible for the cost of retuning equipment affected by its transmissions. But there seems to be a considerable let-out. A summary of its VCR retuning study, issued by the Independent Television Commission, states that the licensee is not liable if the interference to equipment in a specific household is caused only after the installation of equipment, for example a new aerial, to receive Channel 5 in that household. Presumably, the idea is that whoever carries out a Channel 5 installation should be able to deal with any interference problems. But it does look as though this could lead to misunderstandings, to say the least. Also, since this qualification was taken into account in predicting the extent and cost of retuning VCRs, not other equipment apparently, if viewers cotton on to this and delay installing Channel 5 equipment until any interference problems have been dealt with the eventual cost to the Channel 5 licensee, could be far higher than he might have bargained for. The Independent Television Commission's study found that in most parts of the UK where Channel 5 is to be introduced, there will be between 2 and 5 suitable channels within the tuning range of a VCR's modulator for retuning purposes. The main exception is an area of West London extending out to Slough, where there may be difficulties in finding suitable channels for retuning due to problems with Heathrow Airport radar. The report estimates that around 50,000 VCRs in this area might not be able to be retuned satisfactorily. The report suggests 3 alternatives where retuning is not practical. First, a video interface could be used to connect equipment. The problem with this is that so many existing TV sets don't have video input facilities. Secondly, a wide range, covering at least channels 28 to 42, modulator could be connected to the VCR's video output. Finally, a notch filter could be added in series with the television set's aerial input to attenuate interference from an adjacent service area, thus freeing some spectrum space for use by the VCR's UHF output. Because interference from an adjacent area would generally be at a low level, the rejection would not need to be very great, making the filter relatively cheap and easy to produce. Some other problems are highlighted in a couple of letters we've received from readers. That's the editorial news section in Television Magazine, and one of the letters, Channel Planning, from Gareth Foster, who is in Witten in Middlesex. Apparently, with only a few exceptions, the Channel 5 transmissions are going to be cross-polarised with respect to the other 4 services. I wonder who was responsible for such a stupid idea. When I telephoned the ITC about it, I was told that the reason was to prevent interference to Irish and French transmitters that use channels 35 and 37. While I sympathise with the established users of these frequencies, has anyone considered the implications for UK viewers? their existing aerials, even if of the wideband type, will probably give poor results with cross-polarized signals. Mounting the aerial at 45 degrees might work, albeit with a 3 dB loss. But then, the protection against co-channel interference with cross-polarized signals will be lost. Connecting two aerials via a combiner and splitter will probably be unsatisfactory. The new aerial will pick up a degree of signal on the other channels, and this, when added out of phase, will result in ghosts, cancellations, and so on. Use of a proper diplexer with filters would solve the problem, but in A and B group areas, the new channel will generally be only four channels away from an existing one. And although filters with a sufficiently sharp cutoff are feasible, their cost would approach that of a television set. This is clearly not a price the average viewer would pay just to get one extra channel. Another solution would be for manufacturers to fit two aerial sockets to their receivers and VCRs, with the choice of sockets being part of the programming process, but I can't see that happening. The crux of the matter is that these two channels are not, in most cases, the right ones to use. There are alternatives. Channels 36 and 69 are not used for television in the UK. Channel 36 is used for airport radar, and I'm told that channel 69 is a military allocation, though I don't think it's used. Cordless telephones, CT2, have recently been given part of this channel. These users should be kicked out of the UHF bands permanently. Then there are bands 1 and 3, which were originally to have been re-engineered for 625 line transmissions. No doubt the same old story about shortage of spectrum space would be brought up to oppose such suggestions. I'm sure that they have an equally pressing need for spectrum space on the continent, but they manage to hang on to all their broadcasting bands. Perhaps they are better at planning than our DTI is. Broadcasters always seem to have been pushed about in the UK. Shortly before ITV started, back in 1953, Band 3 was given over to private mobile radio use and had to be got back again, some of it not until some years later, thus holding up the growth of the ITV network. And we all know about the consequences of over half of the FM broadcast band being given away for private mobile radio use. Now is the time to sort out our broadcast bands once and for all. It would be a pity and very damaging to introduce a new service that will be virtually unreceivable by the vast majority of people without going to great expense. That letter by Gareth Foster, published in Television Magazine.